Manning had been kind enough to give 3 copies of Microservices in Action by Morgan, Bruce, and Paola Peria to listeners of this podcast. For your chance to win, keep on listening. This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Morgan Bruce, software engineer and author of the recently published book, Microservices in Action. He's joining me from London. Thank you very much for taking time out here today, Morgan.
Thanks, Brian. It's really great to chat to you today.
To start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Morgan. I've been working as a software engineer / engineering manager / VP engineering, I guess what I am now, for the past 10 years, starting in New Zealand, where I'm from, with a trip in between to the Czech Republic and now in London.
That's good. So it wasn't just a trip to the Czech Republic. It was a 2.5-year stopover on the way.
Yeah, exactly. You think you're going to go somewhere for a little while, and then turns out you really love it.
Yeah, been there, done that. Did you work there as a software engineer?
Yeah, I moved over with the company I was working with in New Zealand to help them form a new office there in the Czech Republic, which I thought was really was a fantastic opportunity and really something different for me at the time.
And what do you do now in your role?
Yeah, so I'm the VP engineering at Onfido. So Onfido is a software company. We build SDKs for remote identity verification. So say you're hiring a car, opening a bank account, we build kind of tools for people to detect if there's fraud to help you can prove your identity. So that's the kind of stuff I build. In my job, I lead the engineering team. So I've got 50-something engineers split across London and Lisbon. We've been building the product for around 5 years now and using a kind of microservice approach for just over 3 years.
What technology stack did you choose at your company?
So when we started out, we chose Ruby on Rails, pretty standard startup choice. But over time, that's evolved. So we still have a lot of Rubyists and a lot of Ruby code. But a lot of what we write in production now is either Python, which is particularly useful for the machine learning work that we do, or an Elixir.
I've heard a lot more about Elixir over the last few years. Is it particularly suitable for microservices?
So the Elixir ideology, when you're building applications, you're building them on top of that Erlang Beam VM. And it's quite a different approach to how you build applications and how different components communicate with each other. So in Elixir, you may in fact kind of build what ostensibly independent applications that are communicating with each other within the process boundary of the Elixir VM, Erlang VM, which is a little kind of orthogonal to microservices. So you can build microservices in Elixir, but you don't necessarily need to. It's a slightly different thing.
Tell us about your book. So it was published, was it October this year? October 2018.
Yeah, it was. It was really great to finally have that out. Microservice in Action. My co-author and I, Paolo, we set out, when did we start? Late 2016 to write what we hoped was kind of a real world book about writing and running microservices in production. So when we started, had a really, really heavy focus on deployment, on operations, on service mesh and that kind of thing. Once it hit contact with editors, we kind of expanded it out to really cover the full microservice lifecycle to kind of get a really good overview of microservice practice as it stood when we wrote the book.
How long a process was it to write the book?
Longer than I anticipated. It was the first book I'd written. My co-author had written one book before, so he was perhaps slightly more confident than I was. We started in October 2016, and some chapters went really, really quickly. Knock out a chapter, 2-3 weeks, get it to the editors, comes back, we're really happy. There were some painful chapters in there which were going for 1.5, 2 months. So all in all, roughly a year and a half of writing going into the book.
So for people out there who may be considering writing a book, is this like a second full-time job, or was it very much kind of part-time, didn't ruin your evenings, didn't ruin your weekends?
I can't sugarcoat it. I tried to treat it like a part-time job, but I think it would have gone a lot faster if I'd treated it a bit more closer to a full-time piece of work. In the end, I took a few holidays from work and ended up doing a lot of writing on them, which I think is what really got over the line rather than relying on my evenings and weekends.
One last thing about authoring. Would you write another book?
I think I might need a few years. It's really interesting, and I think I learned a lot about how to structure a book and how to structure ideas in that way. But definitely a big commitment.
Right. For the rest of the podcast, we're going to talk about microservices and looking at the topics that come up within your book. To get us started, though, what is a microservice?
Yeah, sure. So a microservice is a small, independently deployable and autonomous service. So when you build an application with microservice-oriented approach, rather than building and running one large, single monolithic application, your team's going to build an application that's made up of a lot of relatively simple services that interact with each other.
When you say unlike a monolith, what is the primary difference between a microservice and a monolith?
Give me a second to think about the best way to structure this answer.
Yeah. No, because it's a question that often comes up, and I'll have another question for you on that. But yeah, please take your time.
Yeah. So for me, the primary difference is the unit of deployability. So with a monolithic application, you're typically deploying one large application. So that application, say we're talking about a traditional end-to-end type application, we've got a database, we've got a model in the business layer, and we've got a UI. But that application is crossing a number of kind of business domains. So you've got, you might have users in there, you might have bank accounts in there, you might have whatever. All of this kind of functionality within your organization, you're typically building within to one app. In a microservice application, you're trying to find functional boundaries within an app and make those into separately deployable items. So rather than releasing one huge thing at once, you're releasing a number of smaller components independently.
And we'll talk about kind of the functional areas and the boundaries in a little while, but I have seen arguments, particularly coming out of the company Etsy. They're kind of like the eBay for homemade products. And they've written extensively on why they think monoliths are fine for what they do, and it's kind of turned into this big debate. Do you think monoliths can be fine for some people? Because, you know, they've worked for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think the microservice approach invalidates monoliths, right? Like we've built a lot of successful applications, and Etsy is one of those, with monoliths. I think a lot of it for me comes down to, and this is kind of the architect's answer, but it comes down to context, what the organization's needs are, what they're trying to deliver, where they see their trade-offs as being. So if you look at Etsy, their choice of a monolithic approach, I've read some of those articles, and what they talk about in terms of why they've gone down that road is it lets them pour a lot of energy into optimizing a very small and specific set of tools. So they have a principle around use boring technology that lets them say, let's make sure we're really, really good at this stack, at this set of tools, and that way we can focus on shipping product feature with those tools and managing operational overhead. So I think that type of optimization is really cool. Like, I think if you've really focused down that path, you can probably build a monolithic application that's a pleasure to work with and a pleasure to build on. But with the microservice application, you've got different trade-offs. So with the monolithic application, okay, you're saying, I'm only ever going to use these technologies. These are the technologies I think are going to be right for my product in the future. And this is the way that I want my team always to build. On the microservice side, what you're saying to your team is that, okay, we've got a bit more technical flexibility here. We can make different choices in the future or different choices in different areas of the company, depending on what we think is right for now in terms of the technical solution, in terms of the product solution. What I also think is that, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about this when we talk about functional boundaries, is that the strong isolation between components that you get in a microservice really, really helps in the kind of long-term growth of the product, keeping volatility in application well isolated as both the system and the team behind that system grows.
I've read something recently talking about if, let's say, you're starting a new application, whether to start it as a microservice or a monolith. And there was one article I read that was saying, well, start as a traditional end tier because that'll help you figure out your boundaries and then split it up. But of course, we know that often, you know, when you start doing something one way, it doesn't change. So what's your advice on getting started? A new application, greenfield, web-based, yada, yada, yada. Go microservices, not go microservices, end up in microservices?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think the first question I'd always ask myself then is, how much do I know about the domain that I'm building in? So one of the kind of harder things about microservices is how you make the right decisions about what the scope of each particular microservice is. And it's quite hard to make good decisions about the scope of the microservice if you don't understand or don't have a reasonably good understanding of the kind of system domain that you're building that microservice system in. And that's definitely why, in some cases, when you don't have the knowledge, you're moving down the modeler first approach can be beneficial, because it lets you kind of go down a little way, get that better understanding, and then take the decision about breaking things out later, if that makes sense. On the other hand, I do think, if you'd asked me this 3 years ago, 6 years ago, I probably would have said start with a monolith, especially if you've not done microservices before. I think nowadays, if you're starting a new application, to some extent, you've really got a world where you can stand on the shoulders of giants compared to what it was, say, 5 or 6 years ago, in that a lot of the infrastructure for microservices, be that code frameworks like Netflix's Java microservice stack or deployment options like Kubernetes, are a lot more mature and a lot easier for teams to adopt if they want to start on a microservice path. I think if starting a new application a few years ago, you really had to reinvent the wheel to build this type of application well.
How big should a microservice be? Because this is something that's discussed, you know, ad nauseum. That's too big, it's too small, it's not a service because all it does is gets and sets. So in your experience, what's the size of one?
That's a great question, isn't it? I've heard a lot of different rules of thumb. If someone say that it can't be a microservice if it's bigger than 300 lines of code, not a fan of that one. It can't be a microservice.
Who said that? Did they write it down? Can we find them?
I think if we Google it, it'll show up.
Okay.
It must be able to be written in one sprint, or that it must be able to be rewritten in one sprint. It comes back to the context thing. I think none of these are really good rules of thumb that you could apply to every single business or company trying to write microservices. So that makes it a little bit difficult, because you say, well, micro is defined relatively, as in, well, they're clearly not as large as things that aren't microservices. It's not a very useful definition. What I tend to focus on and what I ask my teams to focus on when they're building services is not to focus on, let's say, the quantitative size of the service, but to focus on the scope. So the question you want to ask yourself is, can I say this service has single responsibility? Does it make sense for this to be a service? Second, is the behavior within the service internally cohesive? Have we built a service that has two things which vaguely relate to each other, or one thing that is cohesive and clearly doesn't need to be broken up into a separate service? So it's kind of a little bit of a non-answer, but I don't think there's a right answer for that one.
So I think you said it there in one way, and what I've heard people say is your microservice should be providing some independent, usable piece of business functionality. You know, if it's a checkout service, well, it can do that. If everything else is down, you can still do a checkout if you've somehow managed, let's say, to get items into your cart. What I've heard people, the likes of Jimmy Bogart, Adam Ralph, would say, as long as it can stand on its own and still function, that's a microservice. But I'm sure, you know, there's plenty of debate out there. What do you think, though, about the argument, and this is something that Jimmy Bogart would argue, is that it isn't a single language, it isn't even a single CI/CD, it's that unit of business functionality. So, for example, I could do something in a bit of .NET, a bit of Java, using two different types of CI/CD, as long as that piece of business functionality moves through deployment at the same time and works together, that's still a microservice. That's all language independent.
Are you saying having multiple languages within one microservice?
What I've seen people like, I think Jimmy Bogart and others say, is that the microservice doesn't have to be one language. It doesn't have to be on one type of computer. It doesn't even have to be on one type of CI/CD. As long as the code that provides that service all moves at the same rate, in the sense of it gets deployed at the same time, and that coming together provides that business service, that is still considered a microservice, even though it's multiple languages. What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with the definition. I do think the deployability and the independence and autonomy is the primary feature of the microservice rather than how it's constructed. I struggle to see compelling practical reasons to have microservices that themselves cross multiple languages or multiple deployment boundaries. I think just in terms of like system operation, you're probably adding more complexity there to the deployment of your service than you actually need. There's definitely a lot to be said, even if you're going down the microservice path, for kind of consistency within the service and simplicity, which I feel that perhaps, whilst it's a logical extreme of the definition, perhaps doesn't actually offer.
No, I understand. It absolutely would be more complicated. And it is, as you say, taking it quite down to the literal. It is independent of language, independent of all those other things. But I'll move on, because I wanted to ask you, if you have microservices deployed, you know, let's say we've done it with the one language and we're happy, how do they call each other?
Yeah, sure. So there's two primary approaches for how microservices call each other. So the first is probably the most familiar and most obvious solution is kind of point-to-point synchronous calls. So I think the default approach you always fall down to is microservice exposes some form of API. That might be an HTTP REST API. It's kind of Franca these days. Or you could also use Swift or gRPC or other techniques. So one microservice exposes that API, another service makes a call to that. So pretty straightforward. Second approach would be event-based techniques. So rather than making direct point-to-point calls between different microservices, you're going to have microservices that emit events describing the state of the world or the state of things they've done. So I might have a microservice responsible for, let's say, placing an order. And when that order has been placed, it might emit an event called order completed. And then other microservices that care about orders being completed and need to do something when that happens are going to be listening for that event and reacting when that happens. So rather than making that point-to-point call, you might be using message queries like RabbitMQ or NATS or event streams like Kafka in between those services.
In the first case, when you've got them calling each other, are you introducing coupling in that case that microservice A needs to know about microservice B and also needs to know how to send it a message and receive a response?
Yeah, it's definitely the case that the second approach is extremely decoupled. So that's quite advantageous, of course, to have services that don't even need to know that other services exist. That's probably like the ultimate goal of a really well-architected microservices system. However, I do think that approach where you're calling one service to another, I still think it's quite necessary, even though you're introducing what feels like more coupling between services. Ultimately, there's some system interactions that make more sense as synchronous calls. It's a lot easier to reason about. And of course, with the event-based approach, you've got other challenges. So you need to start reasoning about eventual consistency, things happening on a delayed basis where the whole system is not within a consistent transactionally correct state.
What do you think about using service discovery tools like Consul and the like?
Big fan, to be honest. I don't think ultimately that a service discovery tool decouples you from a understanding. So if we've got a service A calling service A still needs to understand what service B, what capabilities that service provides. So in a logical sense, they're still dependent on each other. The benefit of Consul or another service discovery tool is that the network layer, it lets you decouple yourself somewhat from the location of that service. So if you're deploying across different mediums, say you've got a public-private cloud or even just different deployment mechanisms within the same infrastructure, ultimately that means that the first service doesn't need to know how to find the second service. It can rely on the service discovery tool.
In the case where we've got service A calling service B, And then maybe B calling C and C calling D. How do we track a request as it flows through all those services?
I love this topic. Most of it is run really, really, I think they're one of the challenging elements of microservices. So, and it's challenging because microservices change. So even if I say now, okay, I know that service A calls service B, I know that service B calls service C and D, that's going to change over time because the application is evolving at the level of deployable units. So that kind of mental model that I have at one point in time about how my service interacts is quickly going to become out of date. So the cool thing, of course, in microservices is that we can generate a lot of different data, a lot of telemetry, logs, metrics, traces to understand how that's performing. So when it comes down to tracking those interactions between services over time, even as the system continues to change, I think the best technique is to use distributed tracing. So you've got tools like Jaeger and Zipkin, the kind of open tracing foundation tools. There's a Jaeger example in the book. Commercial options like Datadog or I think it's AWS X-Ray for tracing. So with tracing, with the tracing library, what you're doing as your application microservice runs is collecting spans. So a span is a unit of work, like a function call or an HTTP request, say get users. So as we collect spans, they can be linked together into larger traces and carry additional information. So tags or context values, success or failure, information about the request that was made, and so on. So what we then do, if we're collecting those traces from one service, collecting traces from another service, is we can actually start to link those together across system boundaries. So when service A calls service B, service A can pass some context onto service B that tells service B to connect traces from that service back to service A. So we collect all this information, send it out to an external agent, one of the tools I mentioned before, and that allows us to kind of search and review that data. And to track that request through the system.
If we went down the road of the asynchronous communication, so using the bus and the events, how would we trace communications on that side?
So we'd actually do it in a really similar way. So with the synchronous calls, so say we were making an HTTP call, we typically passed along the parent span ID as an HTTP header, so pretty much a hash ID linking back to the original span. And we can do something very similar with the events or with the queue in that, obviously we're not using HTTP, but we can push those context IDs into the message or the event that we're pushing into the queue. Anything that's consuming those can pick up that context ID and use that to link the spans that they themselves are generating back to the originating system. So the only thing that becomes tricky then is making sure your trace takes into account the time that was spent within the queue, because it's quite likely that the queuing system itself is not integrated with the tracing system. So that's something that you kind of need to reconcile when you receive the event to generate an extra span saying, well, I picked up this event that was put into the queue at 10 minutes ago, and I've picked it up now. Therefore, it's spent 10 minutes in between being emitted from the service upstream.
One of the things that in a company where I was doing some microservices, we hit commonly hit problem by us was sharing data between microservices. So like we have a login service and we have some sort of, let's say, the cart and the checkout and these five other things. But we define that my login service is the owner of the username, password, and a few other things. But maybe I've got something that updates an address. And that needs to know about my full name and maybe something else. Now I need the same data in two microservices. And you often see debates about whether you should call that microservice or keep a copy of it. What are the benefits of either or the detrimental effects of either?
Yeah, sure. I can't remember if we touched on it earlier, but one of the kind of fundamental things that we try and achieve with microservices is that it owns its own data. So the data that a microservice holds or microservice stores isn't necessarily directly accessible by any other service. It's only accessible through an API that microservice provides. So if it's your login service, that login service might be providing an extra API like get user details, reset password, that kind of thing that controls how its data is used. And that's really because, I think it's clear, like, things can get really messy if microservice data has multiple masters, if you've got different things trying to take ownership of the same points of data. But of course, this is where it gets hard, because we've done this. Now we've got data distributed all over the show. And suddenly we can't do things that were easy before. So, you know, SQL joins, for example, things that were in an entire application were quite trivial. So a few options there. The kind of obvious one is to do that kind of composition at the API level. So we need some data, call another service to get that data. So pretty straightforward. And I think for kind of simple use cases, we are retrieving like one data point, one model, one entity. It tends to work okay. But there's kind of different use cases where you might want to retrieve a list of items or hydrate a more complex aggregate across multiple services. At that point, usually run into performance issues, N+1 query issues, where you're making multiple calls to a service or much more calls than are kind of sane to make over a network boundary to process that type of data. So that's where it gets challenging. So this is where the notion of keeping a copy of data or storing read models of data elsewhere potentially becomes useful. So what you're doing there is allowing different services to build up their own kind of representation of the data of another service. And the challenge there becomes, okay, how do they get that data, first of all? And then secondly, how do they keep that data up to date? Which is cool. So we've solved our performance problem, but we've got two new problems to deal with. So the way we've found that we try and do this is to rely on those events that we're emitting. So the microservice is emitting events about the world. What was the example? Order complete.
The login. So a login would know about the user, let's say, and then something else needs to know a little bit about them too.
Exactly. So yeah, let's say login, when the user's created for the first time, it might send out a user created event containing details of the user that was created. Services that are interested in the existence of users would subscribe to that event, take that data and use that data to construct their own model of the user. So that's kind of cool because, you know, you're using this kind of mechanism that you're already building in, events, to do some interesting stuff with data. The complex part becomes, okay, are there times when those downstream services are going to be operating on user data that's out of date? The eventual consistency issue, because now we're relying on events, the user data changes in the login service, we fire up a bunch of events, something else happens in another service before those events have been processed, they're using stale data that's not up to date. So whether that's okay or not really comes down to application semantics. It might be that, well, user data is probably a bad example for that because usually you really want that to be up to date to make sure you're processing the latest thing. It might be that it's okay for the system to process things as stale because it might reprocess it again with updated state in a short time. But there might be situations where we actually need to check and say, do we have the latest version of the user and is it safe for us to use this data? And that becomes quite a complex thing.
Oh, my end-to-year application sounds pretty good around now.
Yeah, I know. This is the less fun part. I definitely think the other thing I think I've kind of seen a lot in naive microservice applications is people trying to serve analytic type workloads out of the microservice application itself. So definitely something that you'll quickly probably can't find yourself doing as your application matures is starting to use those events to actually build up like an analytical store data warehouse type thing for doing that kind of offline processing that you want to do as well.
When we're talking about the sort of the location of the data, the storage of the data, the access to the data by the microservices, what we're touching on are what I think you refer to in your book as service boundaries and what some people call bounded contexts. So can you talk about those, please?
Yeah, sure. So the bounded context term itself comes from domain-driven design. And what it really is a way of splitting up a very large model of your application, of the world, into different contexts. So those contexts are things that reflect natural boundaries within an application. So really different parts of the business, different business capabilities, which we can then reflect in how we structure our services. So in the book, I think we we use these in an example of a customer at a bank. So within one bounded context, let's say it's account management, or login or user details, we care about the things we kind of care about in that domain are the customer's personal details, their financial goals, their history at the branch, this kind of stuff. In a different context, investment was the word looking for, a customer might place orders, but most of the information from account management isn't relevant. So the nature of the customer and what that other context needs to know about the customer wildly varies. So what you kind of see there is the start of two different areas of the system. So clearly I've got some wobbly thing in one side called account management, and clearly I've got one wobbly thing on one side called investment. These by themselves are bounded contexts, and you could take those and say, okay, these are clearly two different microservices. They're probably a little bit large to be single services. What you'll find is that the bounded context gives you a nice place to start in terms of how you might break down your system and how functionality works. But you're actually going to go further within that and break it down a bit more and start to build out a system inside each bounded context that interfaces with a system within another bounded context.
How important is it and how hard is it to get the bounded contexts right?
I think it is really important. Ultimately, if you make poor choices about the service boundaries, you're going to spend more time down the line changing those boundaries later. Although to some extent, that's the nature of software engineering, right? Like you think it's one thing and later on it's another. But definitely in the microservice world, that boundary change comes with a higher cost because you're going to need to change things at the level of the deployable application. So it's possible that the first service I built is too large. So I might want to pull functionality out of that service into another service, or I've built it with the wrong interface to another context altogether, which means I need to move that functionality more substantially and redesign how those services interact, which are all reasonably high cost activities. So definitely important to get right, and definitely important to, I think, the good structure and evolution of a microservice application.
Yeah, I've seen that it can, like you said, it's very, very difficult to sometimes adjust a context significantly. I took part in a workshop some time back where we were looking at the example of a hospital system or, you know, a hospital practices. And the example given was, well, in the end, it's going to be a split between the psychiatric side of the department and the psychiatric side of the hospital and the internal medicine side of the hospital. And that looked great. And then I asked the question, but what if a patient is on drugs from the psychiatric side and they're going for surgery on the internal medicine side, but now you need that information between them? And all of a sudden, the context didn't look as good. But, you know, it was... Up until then, it looked fine, but it's very, very difficult to get these things right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a huge challenge. And obviously, it's not just getting that right for the system as it stands, as you think it stands on day one. It's making sure that the way you design that also allows for system evolution over time. So you can change the system as the requirements change.
Let's say we've done all these things well and we have our bounded context and we've got our queuing between our systems or our good asynchronous calls, and we're going to now to the point of deploying. How do we deploy a microservice or multiple microservices?
Yeah, sure. So it's definitely the case that we're always deploying independently, first of all. So one of the fundamental things about the microservice architecture is that we don't want to deploy services together. We don't want to get to the point where we have to deploy multiple services at once. We always want to build a system where we can deploy one service at one time. But I think deployment's one of my favorite topics and one of my favorite parts of the book for two reasons. The first is because with the microservice architecture, you're kind of working at this level where you're going to be deploying services quite often and deploying new services quite often, your kind of team's ability to deploy a service rapidly and deploy a service without a lot of cost is going to be really vital to how successful you are at developing microservices. If you're slow to deploy, if your deployment process is clunky, takes too long, you're going to find the team start to bias themselves to decisions where they add functionality to existing microservices because it's too hard to deploy new ones. So that's a really big challenge. It really means you've got to get deployment right. second element, which I think is really interesting and makes deployment vital, is that the point of deployment, the point at which your system changes, is typically the riskiest moment in the lifetime of an application. So what that means is that you really want to be sure that you've got that moment controlled as much as possible for every service to kind of maximize your overall stability and availability, especially because now you've got microservices. Every component of the system can potentially be changing at any time, rather than having one big rolling deploy. I think an ideal microservice production environment has a number of qualities that help you achieve those two things. The first is, for every service, you want to have deployment pipeline in the kind of CI, CD sense. So every commit you make, you're verifying that commit as it travels to production, linting, unit tests, component tests, all the usual stuff, nothing really different there to end-to-end applications. Of course, if this CI and CD is consistent across all your different services, I think it simplifies things a bit, particularly if you've got engineers moving between teams or engineers maintaining multiple services. You kind of don't want to have cognitive overhead of, oh, actually, we deploy this one this way, this one that way, this one that way. It's really, really good to standardize that across a larger application. Secondly, you want to have some way for services to be able to call other services. You want to be able to scale services up and down independently, and you want to be able to observe and monitor the environment and understand how those services are interacting. So in the book, I make the argument that Linux and Docker containers and a container scheduler are probably the closest thing in the world to that ideal. So if you're working with containers and make the choice to go down that path, what they do is give devs of microservices a really consistent way of packaging and isolating those containers, as well as a kind of semantically consistent way of running those on a scheduler. So when you come to the time of deployment, what you deploy always looks the same. It's a container, and you always run it the same way. You run it on a scheduler, which manages how you scale that application up and how that application operates in production.
How much effort do you put into accounting for, let's say, rollbacks, rolling back the service, rolling back the database, rolling back the bus between the messages on the bus? Say that, you know, you can have the complication that it might work for a short period. You'd send some messages, then they're in the, some of them are being processed, some are not, and now you need a rollback, but you now have old messages and new messages and reverted messages.
Yeah, that one's not easy. I think the first thing you want to do is try and give yourself a wider window in which to detect that that's happening, but where the potential impact of that happening is not total. So you're not going, taking service version 1 and immediately rolling out version 2, and it's, oh shit, oh god, everything's broken. What you want to do is potentially use a canary deployment. So you take one instance of service 2, roll it out, and that's maybe getting 10% of traffic. So if there is something wrong with that, and you know it's not being picked up by whatever testing you did along the way to that getting production, at the very least, you've limited that impact to 10% of those requests. So take it, roll it back. So you pretty much destroy that instance because no need for it anymore. It's just a canary. And then, of course, survey the damage and look at how you can restore the system to a stable and consistent state. Not when it comes down to data and events, there's not really any kind of catch-all solution to that. It really is try and limit the chance of that happening. And if it does happen, try and limit the breadth of that impact.
How do you monitor, let's say, that 10% or the 90% of your application that's running on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. So I think we touched on this earlier because we talked a little about tracing, and that's obviously one way to monitor how the system's operating and at least to understand how the system's operating. The other two ways are, and I think very similar to what you do in traditional applications, with the flip side of you've got a lot more data generated by a lot of different applications to deal with. So as well as emitting traces, you're probably going to emit logs, so structured log data from every microservice. You want to aggregate that somewhere. You want to make sure you can use that either for generating alerts or for investigative purposes. You're also probably going to want to emit metrics, so time series data from your microservices at each layer of processing. So you're going to want to collect information like how many requests were successful, how long a request is taking, what's the error rate of those requests, And then use that to generate alerts. When it comes down to it, there's kind of four golden signals, let's say, that you're really interested in terms of how the system's operating. So for each microservice, you might be looking at latency. How long is it taking to process things? Has that changed? Is that different? Throughput, is it getting the number of requests I expect it to? Is it getting a wildly anomalous level of requests? Saturation, are the dependencies of those microservices, so database or the underlying CPU or disk space of the instances it's deployed on, are they okay? And lastly, error rates. So how many errors is it getting? Is this a microservice that gets 100% requests and serves them just fine? Is it within kind of 99.999% boundaries, whatever's appropriate for your system, or is this thing failing all the time and causing upstream problems?
Another one of the benefits I've seen is that if, let's say, you've got a few containers with your application running, but they're behaving poorly, you don't tend to try to fix them anymore. You tear them down and redeploy. Is that something that you would advocate for?
Yeah, I think definitely with a little bit of a twist. There's always a risk when you kind of tear down the containers that you lose the context that helped you understand why those things are going wrong. So it's great to do it to fix it, but of course you really want to get down to the root cause later on and try and understand what happened. And hopefully you'll be able to get that from your logs, from your metrics to understand what's happening. But sometimes that isn't the case. So what we try and do is take those containers out of service. So we make sure they're not getting requests served to them anymore, but we don't actually destroy them straight away. We leave them there so someone can come in and take a look and see if they can identify anything that they couldn't identify from other system telemetry.
So let's say we've gone down this path and we love our microservices because we've read about Amazon and Netflix and how they advocate for them. And those companies have massive scale, incredible resources. And let's say, I'll throw it out, best developers in the world. You know, that's obviously questionable. But why is it better for us, let's say a smaller company that doesn't have those needs or those resources?
Yeah, sure. I think there's a number of different advantages that you can realize with microservices. I think they're less evident in really small teams. So teams of five, teams of 10, you're probably not using them to the kind of ultimate or probably not seeing the ultimate gains that you could potentially see out of microservice architecture. But even an engineering team of 40, of 100, you're going to start to see some advantages, particularly once the kind of applications we've been building have been evolving for a few years, once they're not just the greenfield thing you started with, and you're looking to maintain, you're looking to continue to grow and add features. So I think the first is that this ability to innovate, let's say, to create new functionality as new applications, as new deployable units, as a team grows, that's really, really important and really crucial to maintaining development agility and speed. So let's say I start an application today, I build it, I'm building a microservice 4 years down the road. I'm not necessarily beholden to the decisions that I made 4 years ago about that application, as I might be in a monolithic team, or at the very least, I've got a monolith. If I want to make very different decisions, it's very hard to change it that way. With the microservice approach, I can build a new service, I can ship that service independently, and I can work with a lot of autonomy without necessarily being relying too much on the past. The other thing that's advantageous there is that it allows us to isolate the application by areas of volatility. So I might have very mature parts of my application, ones that don't change very often. But at the same time, I might have new stuff that changes a lot, stuff that's evolving very quickly. Being able to isolate those and deploy those separately is really useful from a risk management perspective, because we're ultimately making significantly less risk that we will affect the existing very stable functionality and allows us to move very rapidly for our newer, very volatile functionality. Secondly, I think the thing that's really interesting about microservices is that they allow us to scale those components independently. So rather than throwing, let's say, like undifferentiated computing resource behind one large application, we can direct what we need, what the kind of compute needs of our applications are, to the components independently. So what that should allow you to do is to pretty much optimize how you're serving your application and, if you're in a cloud environment, at the very least, the amount of money you're spending on different functionality. You might have backing components with a very few users that don't actually need to run a lot of machines, don't need a lot of RAM, don't need a lot of CPU power, compared to, let's say, your high traffic front end API, which you can deploy separately and give the resource it needs. Lastly, which I think is a huge benefit for a growing company and a changing company, is the technical flexibility that a microservice architecture gives you. And this is one that I've really clearly seen myself. At my current company, we started out, we built a Ruby on Rails app, as you do, which was okay at the time and worked really well for what our business originally was. But as many startups do, we kind of pivoted along the way and started going down a very different technical path. And that technical path simply wouldn't have been possible within our original application or within our original tech stack at all. So the fact that we could at that time say, look, let's evolve to this microservice approach was really productive, because it enabled us to move that way without a lot of friction and without a lot of dependency on what became before.
Yeah, you can move piece by piece, I imagine.
Exactly.
Any final notes before we wrap up for today, Morgan?
Not really. It's been fantastic kind of going over everything, trying to remember what I wrote in the book, of course. All I can say is that I do think the microservice approach is a really compelling way to architect applications, particularly in growing teams. And of course, I hope if you buy the book that you enjoy it and that you get something useful out of it.
Yep. And Manning have given us 3 copies to give away, and I'll have some notes at the very end on how to possibly win 1 copy. Well, Morgan, Bruce, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Brian. It's been a pleasure.
For your chance to win a copy of Morgan's book, Microservices in Action, leave a comment on the post related to this podcast. You'll find a link in the show notes. If you like this episode, you might also like episode 110 with Brandon Byers about testing microservices with Mountebank, or episode 99 with Jimmy Bogard diving into containers, or episode 91 with Adam Ralph on in-service bus microservices and service-oriented architectures, or episode 89 with Mark Eisenberg about breaking the monolith. The opening music was Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was The Hours by Scott Grattan from the album Subtract and Divide.